days, and I had to jump on a plane to the States. I brought her a musical snowshaker of New York, snatched up in Saks Fifth Avenue, as a consolation present, but it was no consolation. The times you don't make it are the ones children remember, not the times you do. I'm anxious to slip away and call the office, but there is no avoiding Alexandra Law, who is accepting rave notices for Genevieve's Virgin Mary and for her own Bavarian Liebekuchen. Alexandra picks up one of my mince pies, jabs a dubious fingernail into the hill of icing sugar on top, before pushing the whole lot into her mouth and announcing her verdict through a shower of crumbs.
"Sensational mince pies, Kate. Did you soak the fruit in brandy or grappa?"
"Oh, a dash of this and that, Alex. You know how it is." She nods.
"I was thinking of asking everyone to make Stollen for next year. What do you think? Do you have a good recipe?"
"No, but I know a supermarket that does."
"Very good."
Alexandra is the only woman I know who laughs as though it was written down. Mirthless, heaving Ted Heath shoulders. Any second now, she will ask me if I've gone part-time yet.
"So, are you working part-time now?"
"No, still full-time. Good heavens. I don't know how you do it, honestly. I say, Claire, I was just saying to Kate, I don't know how she does it. Do you?"
7:27 p.m. The strain of being an angel has taken its toll on Emily. She is so exhausted that I calculate I can turn over 3 pages of the bedtime story without her noticing. Must get on with that email backlog. But just as I am skipping the pages, a suspicious eye snaps open.
"Mummy, you made a mistake."
"Did I?"
"You left out the bit where Piglet jumps in Kanga's pocket."
"Oh dear, did I?"
"Never mind, Mummy. We can just start at the beginning again."
8:11 p.m. The answer phone that sits on the table next to the TV is full. Play messages. A West Country burr informs me that QuickToy is returning my call about undelivered Christmas presents.
"Unfortunately, owing to unprecedented demand, the items will not now be with you until the new year."
Christ! What's wrong with these people? A message from my mother comes up next and takes up most of the tape. Nervous of the technology, Mum still leaves pauses for the person at the other end to reply. She rang to say not to worry, she will manage fine without us over Christmas. Somehow her reassurance is more piercing than any complaint could be. It's the knockout 1-2 that mothers have perfected down the centuries. First they make you feel guilty, and then you feel resentful at being made to feel guilty, which makes you feel even worse.
"I've put some books for Emily and Ben in the post, and a little something for you and Richard. I hope they'll be the right sort of thing."
She is afraid of not pleasing, in this as in so much else. After my mother's wan reproachfulness, it's a relief to hear the voice of Jill Cooper-Clark wishing me a happy Christmas. Sorry she hasn't got organized with cards this year, been a bit dicky. Laughter. Although at least her new doctor looks like Dirk Bogarde. Sends her love, and asks me to give her a call sometime. Finally, I hear a voice so drained of warmth I barely recognize it. Janine, a former broker friend. Janine gave up work last year when her husband's firm floated on the stock market and Graham came into the kind of wealth that buys you a yacht called Tabitha, once owned by a cousin of Aristotle Onassis. When Janine was still working, we used to enjoy the battle-weary camaraderie of running a home while trying to make it across man's land, avoiding sniper fire. These days, Janine does afternoon classes at the Chelsea Physic Garden on how to get the most out of your seasonal window box. She has winter and summer covers for her sofas, which get changed at the correct time of year, and lately she has arranged all the family photographs in padded albums, which sit on the coffee table in her drawing room, exuding the mellow smells of leather and contentment. Last time I asked Janine what she was up to, she gave a little trill and said,
"Oh, you know, just pottering."
"No, I don't know. Pottering and me, I don't think we've been introduced." Janine is ringing to check if we're coming to their New Year's Eve dinner. She's sorry to bother us. She doesn't sound sorry. She sounds spitty with the indignation of a hostess scorned. What New Year's dinner?
A few minutes of excavating the hall table, tandoori leaflets, dead leaves, a single brown mitten, turns up an unopened pile of Christmas post. I riffle through the envelopes till I get to the one addressed in Janine's careful copperplate. Inside is a card photo montage of Graham, Janine, and their perfectly untroubled children, plus an invitation to dinner. RSVP by December 10th. I now do what I always do on such occasions. I blame Richard. It doesn't have to be his fault, but someone has to be landed with the blame, or how is life to be tolerated? Kneeling on the kitchen floor, Rich is making Ben a reindeer out of cardboard and what looks like the missing brown mitten. I tell him we are no longer even capable of turning down the events we will be unable to attend. Our social ostracism is nearly complete. I'm suddenly overcome with longing to be one of those women who reply promptly to invitations on thick, creamy notepaper with a William Morris border. And in fountain pen, not some drought-stricken jade felt tip I have raided from Emily's pencil case. Rich shrugs.
Come off it, Kate. You'd go mad.
Perhaps, but it would be nice to have the choice. 11:57 p.m. The bath. My favourite place on earth. Leaning over the empty tub, I clear out the Pingu toys and the wrecked galleon, unstick the alphabet letters, which, ever since the vowels got flushed down the loo, have formed angry Croat injunctions around the rim. Shh. I peel off the crusty, half-dry Barbie flannel that has started to smell of something I vaguely remember as tadpole, and then, starting at one corner, I lift up the non-slip mat, whose suction cups cling for a second before yielding with an indignant burp. Next I ransack the cabinet, looking for a relaxing bath oil. Lavender, sea cucumber, bergamot. But I am always out of distresses and have to settle for something with bubbles called vitality in nuclear lime. Then I run the water hotter than you can bear. So hot that when I climb in, my body momentarily mistakes it for cold. Lie back, nostrils flaring over the surface like an alligator. I look at the woman rapidly vanishing in the steamy mirror by my side, and I think this is her time alone, save for the odd overlooked Barney the dinosaur bobbing up suddenly between her knees with its serial killer grin. The bath is ancient, its porcelain riddled with grey-blue veins. We ran out of money after doing the kitchen, so the house is in ascending order of crud. The higher up you go, the lower the standards. Kitchen by Terrace Conran, sitting room by IKEA, bathroom by Fungus the Bogeyman. But with my contact lenses out and in the candlelight, the bathroom's leprous peeling speaks to me of some Vestal Roman temple rather than 5 grand's worth of absent damp course. As the bubbles evaporate on my hands, scaly pink eyelets are revealed along the knuckles. It's already got behind my right ear. Stress eczema, the nurse at work called it. Can you think of any way to relieve some of the pressures in your life, Kate? Oh, let's see now. A brain transplant? A lottery win? My husband reprogrammed to figure out that things left at the bottom of the stairs usually need to be carried to the top of the stairs. Can't see how I can go on like this. Can't see how to stop, either. Can't help wondering if I was too hard on that Sri Lankan girl at the induction today. Momo somebody. Seemed sweet enough. She asked me to be honest. Should I have been? Told her that the only way to get on at EMF is to act like one of the boys, and when you act like one of the boys, they call you abrasive and difficult. So you act like a woman, and then they say you're emotional and difficult. Difficult being their word for everything that's not them. Well, she'll learn. If I'd known at her age what I know now, would I ever have had children? Close my eyes and try to imagine a world without Emily and Ben. Like a world without music or lightning. Sink back under the water to let my thoughts float free, but they feel stuck to my brain like barnacles. Must remember. Talk with Paula, outlining firm new approach to children's haircuts, timekeeping, etc. Talk with Rod Task, outlining firm new approach to role with clients, i.e. I am not their emergency geisha. Pay rise. Repeat after me, I will not accept extra work without extra money. Get quote for new stair carpet.
by Christmas tree and stylish lights. John Lewis or IKEA. Present for Richard. How to be a domestic goddess? In-laws. Cheese barrel or alpine plants advertised in Sunday Times colour supplement. Where did I put the cutting? Stocking fillers for E&B. Fruit jellies, Uncle Alf. Travel 6 weeks? Ask Paula, collect dry cleaning. Personal shopper, how much? Pelvic floor, squeeze. Make icing for Christmas cake. Too late. Buy Roland stuff. Card stamps, first class times 30. Wean Ben off dummy. Remember Rue. Ring Quick Toy Useless Bloody Present Company and threaten legal action. Nappies, bottles, Toy Story video, smear test, highlights. Hamster? Chapter 3. Happy Holidays. I can get myself and two children washed and dressed and out of the house in half an hour. I can juggle 9 different currencies in 5 different time zones. I can make myself come with quiet efficiency. I can prepare and eat a stand-up supper while on the phone to the West Coast. I can read Guess How Much I Love You to Ben scanning the prices on teletext. But can I get a minicab to take me to the airport? As part of an ongoing program of cutbacks, Edwin Morgan Forster will no longer send a car to deliver me to Heathrow. I must order my own. Last night I booked a local minicab, which this morning failed to show. When I rang to protest, the guy at the other end said he was very sorry, but the soonest they could get a car to me was half an hour.
It's a busy time of day, love.
I know it's a busy time of day. That's why I pre-booked last night. Says he thinks he may be able to get me something in 20 minutes. Hotly reject this insulting offer and slam phone down. Immediately regret it, as all the other companies I call either don't have a car available or suggest an even more disastrous waiting time. I'm in despair when I spot a dirty bronze card sticking out from under the doormat. It's for a taxi company I've never heard of. Pegasus, your winged driver. When I dial the number, the guy at the other end says he's coming right over. Relief is short-lived. This being Hackney, what turns up at the door is Pegasus, your stoned driver. Parked at almost 45 degrees to the curb, Pegasus's chariot is a Nissan Sunny of impenetrable gloom, hung about with veils of nicotine and hash. Climb in, but it's technically impossible to breathe in cab, so try to roll down window and stick head outside like a dog.
Window is not working,
volunteers the driver, factually and without regret. And the seatbelt?
Not working.
You do realize that's illegal. In the rearview mirror, Pegasus shoots me a pitying look that instructs me to get a life. The cab not turning up made me so tense I had this stupid, stupid row with Richard. He found Paula's Christmas bonus check, which I'd hidden in Emily's lunchbox. Said he simply couldn't understand why I spent more on the nanny's Christmas present than on the rest of the family put together. I tried to explain, because if I don't keep Paula happy, she will leave.
Would that really be so bad, Katie?
Frankly, it would be easier if you left.
Ah, I see.
Shouldn't have put it like that. Damned tiredness. Always makes you say what you don't mean to say, even if you feel it at the time. After that, Rich sat at the kitchen table pretending to have found something fascinating to read in Architectural Digest while managing to look like Trevor Howard at the end of Brief Encounter, all chin-up decency and glittery eyes. Wouldn't even look at me when I said goodbye. Then Ben stood up in his high chair and started yodeling for a hug. No, sorry, not in a clean suit. The state of him, smeared with jam and apricot fromage fray, like his own personal sunrise. The cab stops and starts and stops again along the Euston Road. If this is one of London's main arteries, then London needs a coronary bypass. Its citizens sit in their cars, hearts furring up with fury. Once we're past King's Cross, I open my post. There's a card from Mum, enclosing a magazine's Yuletide supplement. 26 recipes for a magical, stress-free Christmas. Flick through pages in mounting disbelief. How can anything stress-free involve caramelizing a shallot? We continue to crawl westwards, over the flyover and past the brick-pink semis, like mile upon mile of gaping dentures. When I used to live in a house like that, Christmas was still a pretty simple affair. It was a tree, a pimply turkey, satsumas trapped in an orange net, maybe some dates clinging gummily together in a palm tree canoe, and a bumper tin of Quality Street eaten by the whole family in front of Morecambe and Wise. Your big present was always waiting for you downstairs next to the tree. A doll's house, roller skates, maybe a bike with training wheels or a bell, and there was a stocking whose thrilling misshapen weight your feet discovered at the end of the bed. But Christmas, like everything else, has moved up a gear. Now it's productions of The Nutcracker, book tickets in August, and Kelly Bronze. When I first heard the name, I assumed Kelly was one of those inflatable Baywatch babes, but she turns out to be the only kind of turkey that's worth eating anymore. And once you've spent an hour on the phone, being held in a queue in order to beg the supermarket to put you on the waiting list for Kelly, you have to get the bird home and stuff her. According to my Yuletide supplement, stuffing, which was once stale breadcrumbs with diced onion and a spoonful of fusty sage, has evolved into porcini butter with red rice and cranberry to revive jaded palates. I don't believe we had palates in the 70s. We had sweet teeth and heartburn that you eased by sucking lozenges the colour and texture of gravestones. It's a good joke when you think about it, isn't it? Just as women were fleeing the role of homemaker in their millions, there was suddenly food that was worth cooking. Think of all the great stuff you could be making, Kate, if you were ever in your kitchen to make it. 8:43 a.m. Pegasus has chosen a quick back route to Heathrow. So, with 1 hour 22 minutes to take off, we are sitting outside a row of halal butchers in Southall. Feel my heart revving, foot jammed on an invisible accelerator. Look, can't you go any faster? I absolutely have to make up time. A young guy in white cotton pyjamas steps out into the road in front of us, a lamb the size of a child slung over his shoulder. My driver brakes suddenly, and from the front of the car comes a laconic drawl.
Last time I looked, lady, running people over still against the law.
Close eyes and concentrate on calming down. Things will feel much more under control if I make efficient use of the time. Call QuickToy, round-the-clock fun, on mobile, to complain about no show of vital Christmas presents.
Thank you for choosing QuickToy. We are sorry you are held in a queue. Your call will be answered shortly.
Typical. Start to work my way through torn-out Yellow Pages list of North London pet shops. It comes as no surprise to learn there is a national shortage of baby hamsters, though there might be one left in Walthamstow. Am I interested? Yes. When I finally get through to QuickToy, clueless operative seems reluctant to admit they have any record of my order. Tell him I am a major shareholder in his company, and we are about to review our investment.
All right, he concedes. There have been some delivery difficulties owing to unprecedented demand.
I point out that the demand can hardly be described as unprecedented. The birth of the little baby Jesus. Been celebrating that one for 2,000 years. Toys and Christmas? Christmas and toys? Ring any bells?
Would you be asking for a voucher, miss?
No, I would not be asking for a voucher. I am asking for my toys to be delivered immediately so my children will have something to open on Christmas Day. There is a pause, a beep, and an echoey shout.
Oi, Jeff! Some posh tart's doing her nut on the phone about the Goldilocks porridge set and the push-along sheepdog. What am I going to tell her?
9:17 a.m. Arrive at Heathrow with time to spare. Decide to try to make it up to the driver for yelling. Ask his name.
Winston,
he offers suspiciously. Thanks, Winston. That was a really good route. I'm Kate, by the way. Such a great name, Winston. As in Churchill. He savours the moment before replying,
as in Silcott.
9:26 a.m. Barging through a choked departure lounge, remember something else I have forgotten. Need to call home. Mobile not in service. Why not? try payphone, which eats £3 coins and fails to connect me, while repeating the message.
Thank you for choosing British Telecom.
Finally, get through on credit card phone next to the boarding desk, watched by three members of staff in Navy uniforms.
Richard, hello. Whatever you do, don't forget the stockings.
Lingerie?
What?
Stockings. Is there a lingerie angle here, Katie? Suspenders, black lace, 3 inches of creamy thigh, or are we talking boring old Santa gift receptacle?
Richard, have you been drinking?
It's an idea, certainly.
As he puts the phone down, I swear I can hear Paula offering Emily a hubba-bubba.
My daughter is not allowed bubblegum.
To Candy Stratton, from Kate Reddy in Stockholm.
Client threatening to drop us on account of worrying dip in fund performance. Spun them a line about Edwin Morgan Forster asset managers being like Bjorn Borg. Brilliant baseline stayers, playing percentage shots and aiming for consistent victories over the long term, not flashy burnout artists going for quick profits and then double faulting. Seemed to buy it. God knows why. Kept popping out of Bengt Bergman boardroom to executive washroom, locking self in cubicle and using mobile to call pet shops in Walthamstow. Up until 3 days ago, Emily's letters to Santa made no mention of hamster, now suddenly upgraded to number one item. Swedish clients all have names like a bad hand of Scrabble. Sven Sjörström kept spearing roll mops off my plate at lunch and saying he was a passionate believer in closer European Union. Trust me to get only non-PC man in Scandinavia. Yuck. Kate kisses.
To Kate Reddy, from Candy Stratton.
Sven, will I see you again? Sven, will we share precious moments?
Go for it, hon. It will relax you.
Love, cystitis. Kisses.
To Candy Stratton, from Kate Reddy.
That is not funny. Remember, I am a happily married woman.
Well, I'm married anyway.
To Kate Reddy, from Deborah Richardson.
Have just had unspeakable humiliation at hands, or rather mouth, of hateful school secretary at Piper Place. I know, should stop this education madness.
Yes, Ruby could be assessed for a place for 2002, but I must warn you, Mrs. Richardson, that there are over 100 little girls on our list, and we have a strong siblings policy.
Do you have any Semtex? These smug cows have got to be stopped. What's new?
To Deborah Richardson, from Kate Reddy.
Have not put M down for school yet. By the time I get round to it, we'll probably have to have sex with the headmaster to have any chance of getting her in. More pressing problem. 2 days to wean Ben off dummy, cause mother-in-law thinks this sucking device is tool of the devil, only used by gypsies or chain-smoking lowlifes who park children in front of the video. What else to do with children in Yorkshire? Have found hamster for Emily. Apparently female hamsters, very bad-tempered, and sometimes bite or eat their young. Now, why would that be?
2:17 a.m. Blizzard. Flight home delayed. Precious seconds set aside for last-minute shopping in London being eaten up. Scour Stockholm Airport shop for Christmas presents. Which would Rich prefer? Wind-dried reindeer or seasonal video entitled Swedish Teen Honeys in the Snow? Still refusing to buy Emily vulgar, messy baby wee-wee as seen on breakfast TV. Compromise on the local Swedish Barbie-type doll. Wholesome individual, probably a social democrat, wearing peacekeeper khaki. Christmas Eve, offices of Edwin Morgan Forster. I should have known where my pay negotiations were going when Rod Task came round the back of my chair, air-patted my shoulder 3 times like a vet preparing a cat for a jab, and described me as a highly valued member of the team. It was mid-afternoon, the dregs of the day, and the sky over Broadgate was the colour of tea. Rod explained that there would be no bonus this year, the bonus I have been counting on to finish the building work on the house and for so much else. Times were tough for everybody, he said, but the really great news was they were giving me a major new challenge.
We think you're the person to do client servicing, Katie.
because you do it so damn well. Anyway, she got the best legs.
A burly and curly Aussie, with a voice other guys used to get the attention of a bartender, when Rod first heaved his bulk over from Sydney to join EMF as director of marketing 3.5 years ago, brought in to put some lead in the English firm's propelling pencil, I really thought I'd have to leave. His inability to look me in the eye, and not just because I'm 2 inches taller, the way he would comment on parts of my body as though they were on special offer, his habit of ending every meeting with an injunction to get out there and kick the fucking tires. After a few weeks, when Candy sweetly asked Rod for an English translation of this phrase, he looked perplexed for a few seconds, then gave a broad grin.
Screw the client for every penny you can.
So I was going to have to leave. But then Emily hit the terrible twos, and I bought a book called Toddler Taming. It was a revelation. The advice on how to deal with small, angry, immature people who have no idea of limits and were constantly testing their mother applied perfectly to my boss. Instead of treating him as a superior, I began handling him as though he were a tricky small boy. Whenever he was about to do something naughty, I would do my best to distract him. If I wanted him to do something, I always made it look like it was his idea. Anyway, Rod says that from today, I assume responsibility for the Salinger Foundation. Based in New York, chief executive by the name of Jack Abelhammer, $200 million business, needs someone of my caliber. I'll be able to familiarize myself with the portfolio over the holidays, of course. Plus, I will continue to babysit all my old clients while Rod finds the right person to take over from me. I ask Rod what Abelhammer is like.
Good swing.
I beg your pardon?
Short game. Needs work.
Oh, golf.
What do you think I'm talking about, Katie? Sex?
The holiday doesn't strictly begin till close of play today, but the office is practically deserted. Unofficially, we are now in the limbo between boozy lunch and alcoholic tea. When I get back to my desk, Candy is perched on the heater under the window, with her legs stretched out and resting on top of my chair. She is wearing an amazing cantilevered scarlet blouse and purple fishnets, and there is gold tinsel in her hair.
"Okay, let me guess," she says. "He took a crap on you, and you offered to wipe his ass."
"Excuse me?" I grab her ankles and spin her feet off the chair. "Actually, things went very well. Rod thinks my client handling skills are a major asset, so as a vote of confidence they are giving me this big foundation all to myself."
"Right."
When Candy laughs, you get a glimpse of a mouthful of enviable American teeth. "Don't look at me like that."
"Kate, a major vote of confidence round here always comes with at least 4 zeros on the end of it. You know that. What else did he say?"
I don't have time to reply, because Candy puts a finger to her lips as Chris Bunce, bastard in residence, sways past us on his way to the gents with a long lunch under his belt. A major cokehead, Bunce manages to look both skinny and bloated. Since I made it clear to him, quite politely, that I wasn't interested in the contents of his boxers, the sexual tension between us has given way to teasing skirmishes, with occasional rounds of live ammunition being fired when I get a deal he wants. Guys like Bunce see rejection as an insult that must be repaid with compound interest, like the third world debt. Candy tips her head towards his retreating figure.
"Lot of dirt getting into EMF one way and another. Do you offer to clean the office for them too?"
"What do you take me for? Rod said no one was getting a bonus."
"And you believed him?"
Candy closes her eyes and sighs a smile.
"That's what I love about you, Kate. Smartest female economist since Maynard Keynes, and you still think when they mug you they're doing you a favor."
"Candy, Maynard Keynes was a man." She shakes her head, and the tinsel sends out prickles of light.
"He was not. He was a fruit. Way I see it, we women have to claim all the guys in history with a strong feminine side as ours."
6:09 p.m. Packing the car for the journey up north to my parents-in-law takes at least 2 hours. There is the first hour, during which Richard pieces together a pleasing jigsaw of baby belongings in the boot. Louis XIV travels lighter than Ben. Then comes the moment where he has to find the key that unlocks the luggage box that sits like an upturned boat on our roof.
Where did we put it, Kate?
After 10 minutes of swearing and emptying every drawer in the house, Richard finds the key in the pocket of his jacket. After Rich has told me to get the kids in the car,
right now,
there follows 20 minutes of frantic unloading as he just makes sure. He has packed the sterilizer, which he knows for a fact, he wedged next to the spare tire. This is followed by a furious repacking, punctuated by fuck-its, when items are squidged on top of one another any old how, and the remnants are jammed into all available foot space, front and back. The easy wipe changing mat, the easy clip portable high chair with its companion piece, the Vermilion easy assemble porticot. Bibs, melamine Thomas the Tank engine bowls, sleep suits. Emily's blankie, a tragic hank of yellow wool that looks as though it has been run over several times by a heavy goods vehicle. An entire bestiary of nocturnal comforters. Ben's beloved roo, a sheep, a hippopotamus in a tutu, a wombat that is an eerie Roy Hattersley double. Ben's dummies, to be hidden from Richard's parents at all costs. Emily's surprise hamster is stashed in the boot. Strapped into their seats in the back of the car, like cosmonauts awaiting blastoff, Emily and Ben's contented bickering soon gives way to hand-to-hand combat. In a moment of weakness, when do I have a moment of strength? I have opened the chocolate Santa dispenser, meant for Christmas morning, and given them a couple of foil-wrapped pieces each to keep them quiet. As a result, Emily, who 15 minutes ago was wearing white pajamas, now looks like a Dalmatian, with a dark brown muzzle around her mouth and cocoa smudges everywhere else. Richard, who has a heroic indifference to the cleanliness and general presentation of his offspring for 11.5 months of the year, suddenly asks me why Ben and Emily look such a mess. What's his mother going to think? Swipe at children with moist travel tissues. 4 hours on the A1 motorway lie ahead of us. Car is so overloaded it sways like a ship.
Are we still in England?
Demands an incredulous voice from the back. Yes.
Are we at Grandma's house yet?
No.
But I want to be at Grandma's house.
By Hatfield, both children are performing a fugue for scream and whimper. Crank up the carols from King's tape, and Rich and I sing along gustily. Rich is the descant specialist, while I take the Jesse Norman part. Near Peterborough, 80 miles out of London, a small, nagging thought manages to wriggle its way clear from the compost heap that presently comprises the contents of my head. Rich, did you remember to pack Roo?
I didn't know I was meant to be remembering Roo. I thought you were remembering Roo.
Like any other family, the Shattucks have their Christmas traditions. One tradition is that I buy all the presents for my side of the family, and I buy all the presents for our children, and our 2 godchildren, and I buy Richard's presents, and presents for Richard's parents, and his brother Peter, and Peter's wife Cheryl, and their 3 kids, and Richard's uncle Alf, who drives across from Matlock every Boxing Day, and is keen on rugby league, and can only manage soft centres. If Richard remembers, and depending on late opening hours, he buys a present for me.
What have we got for Dad, then?
Rich will inquire on the drive up to Yorkshire. The marital we, which means you, which means me. I buy the wrapping paper and the sellotape, and I wrap all the presents. I buy the cards and a large sheet of second-class stamps. By the time I have written all the cards and forged Rich's signature and written something warm yet light-hearted about time flying and how we'll definitely be in touch in the new year, a lie, it is too late for second-class mail, so I join the queue at the post office to buy first-class stamps. Then I fight my way through Selfridge's food hall to buy a cheese and those little Florentines that Barbara likes. And then, when we get to Barbara and Donald's house, we unpack the stuff from the car, and we put all the presents under the tree and the food and the drink in the kitchen. And they chorus, "Oh, Richard, thank you for getting the wine. You shouldn't have gone to all that trouble." Is it possible to die of ingratitude? Midnight Mass, St. Mary's, Rothley. The grass on the village green is so full of ice tonight it's almost musical. We clink and chink our way from the Shattuck's old mill house to the tiny Norman church. Inside the pews are full, the air dense and dank and flavoured with winey breath. I know you're meant to disapprove of the drunks who only come to church this one time in the year, but standing here next to Rich, I think how much I like them, envy them even. Their noisy attempts at hush, the sense they've come in search of heat and light and a little human kindness. I hold it together, I really do, until we get to that line in O Little Town of Bethlehem, when I have to press both gloves to my eyes. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Chapter 4. Christmas Day. Saturday, 5:37 a.m., Rothley, Yorkshire. It's still dark outside. The four of us are in bed together, in a sprawling, tentacular cuddle. Emily, half mad with Santa lust, is tearing off wrapping paper. Ben is playing peepo with the debris. I give Richard a packet of wind-dried reindeer, 2 pairs of Swedish socks, oatmeal, a 5-day wine-tasting course in Burgundy, and how to be a domestic goddess, joke. Barbara and Donald give me a wipeable Liberty print apron and how to be a domestic goddess, not joke. Richard gives me 1, Agent Provocateur underwear, red bra with raised black satin spots and demitasse cup over which nipples jut like helmeted medieval warriors peeking above a parapet. Also, a suspender-slash-knicker device, apparently trimmed with trawlerman's netting, and, 2, membership of National Trust. Both fall into category of what I think of as PC presents. Please change. Emily gives me a fantastic travel clock. Instead of an alarm, it has a message recorded by her.
Wake up, Mummy! Wake up, sleepyhead!
We give Emily a hamster. Female, but to be called Jesus. A Barbie bike, a Brambly Hedge doll's house, a remote control robot dog, and a lot of other stuff made out of plastic that she doesn't need. Emily is thrilled with the peacekeeper Barbie I snatched up in Stockholm duty-free, until she opens Paula's present. Baby Wee Wee, which I have expressly forbidden. Risking hysteria, we try to get most of the kids' gifts unwrapped upstairs so that my parents-in-law will not be appalled by reckless metropolitan surfeit.
Throwing your money about.
And the outrageous spoiling of the younger generation.
In my day, you counted yourself lucky to get a doll with a china head and an orange.
Some things are harder to keep quiet. It's difficult to pretend to grandparents, for instance, that your child is just an occasional video watcher when, during breakfast, she gives a word-perfect rendition of every song from The Little Mermaid, adding brightly that the DVD version has an extra tune. At the table I sense another source of conflict when I remind Emily to stop playing with the salt. Emily, Grandpa asked you to put that down.
No, I didn't, says Donald mildly. I told her to put it down. That's the difference between my generation and yours, Kate. We told. You ask.
A few minutes later, standing by the aga, stirring scrambled egg, I am suddenly aware of Barbara hovering by my side. She finds it hard to conceal her disbelief at the contents of the saucepan.
Goodness! Do the children like their eggs dry?
Yes. This is the way I always do them.
Oh.
Barbara is obsessed with the food intake of my family, whether it's the children's lack of vegetables or my own strange unwillingness to plough through 3 3-course meals a day.
You need to build your strength up, Catherine.
And no Shattuck family gathering would be complete without my mother-in-law pressing me into the African violet nook next to the pantry and hissing,
Richard looks thin, Catherine. Isn't Richard looking thin?
When Barbara says thin, it immediately becomes a fat word. Hefty, breathless, accusing. I shut my eyes and try to summon reserves of patience and understanding I don't have. The woman standing before me equipped my husband with the DNA that gave him the lifelong figure of a biro refill,
and 36 years later she blames me. Is this fair? I rise above such slights on my wifeliness, what there is of it.
But Richard is thin, I protest. Rich was skinny when we met. That's one of the things I loved about him.
He was always slim, concedes Barbara, but now there's nothing left of him. Cheryl said as soon as she saw him get out of the car, doesn't Richard look run down, Barbara?
Cheryl is my sister-in-law. Before she married Peter, Richard's accountant brother, Cheryl was something in the Halifax Building Society. Since she had the first of her three boys in 1989, Cheryl has become a member of what my friend Deborah calls the Mafia, the powerful stay-at-home cabal of organized mums. Both Cheryl and Barbara treat men as though they were livestock who need careful husbandry. No Christmas in the Shattuck family would be complete without Cheryl asking me if my Joseph Cashmere roll neck is from J.C. Penney, or if it's really all right that Rich should be upstairs bathing the children by himself. Peter is a lot less help with the family than Richard, but over the years I have come to see that Cheryl enjoys and even encourages her husband's uselessness. Peter plays the valuable role in Cheryl's life of the cross I have to bear. Every martyr needs a Peter who, given time, can be trained up not to recognize his own underpants. Things I take for granted at home in London are viewed up here as egalitarianism gone mad.
Somme, says Richard in grim triumph, walking through the kitchen holding aloft a bulging nappy sack whose apricot scent is fighting a losing battle to subdue the stink within.
Rich has evolved a classification system for Ben's nappies. A minor incident is a tompi, an average load is a croque manure, while an all-out seven wipes job is a somme. Once, but only once, there was a Krakatoa. Fair enough, but not in a Greek airport.
Of course, in our day the fathers didn't pitch in at all, says Barbara, flinching. You wouldn't get Donald going near a nappy. Drive a mile to avoid one.
Richard's fantastic, I say carefully. I couldn't manage without him. Barbara takes a red onion and quarters it fiercely.
You've got to look after them a bit, men. Delicate flowers, she muses, pressing the blade down till the onion cries softly to itself.
Can you give that gravy a stir for me, Catherine?
Cheryl comes in and starts defrosting cheese straws and vol-au-vent cases for tomorrow's drinks party. I feel so alone when Barbara and Cheryl are twittering together in the kitchen, even though I'm standing right there. I reckon this must be how it was for centuries, women doing the doing and exchanging conspiratorial glances and indulgent sighs about the men. But I never joined the Mafia. I don't know the code, the passwords, the special handshakes. I expect a man, my man, to do women's work, because if he doesn't, I can't do a man's work. And up here in Yorkshire, the pride I feel in managing, the fact that I can and do make our lives stay on track, if only just, curdles into unease. Suddenly I realize that a family needs a lot of care, a lubricant to keep it running smoothly, whereas my little family is just about bumping along and the brakes are starting to squeal. Richard walks back into the kitchen, minus nappy, puts his arms round my waist, hoists me up onto the rail of the aga, rests his head in the crook of my neck and starts to twiddle my hair, just like Ben does. Happy, sweetheart? It sounds like a question, but really it's an answer. Rich is happy here, I can tell, with the womanly bustle and the fug of baking and me not on the phone every 5 minutes.
He's a real homebody, is our Richard, says Barbara proudly.
I tell Rich, and I'm only partly joking, that he would have been better off marrying some nice Sloane with a super line in mince pies.
Well, I didn't, because I would have died of boredom. Anyway, he says, stroking my cheek and tucking a stray tendril of hair behind my ear, if we need mince pies, I know this incredible woman who can fake them.
12:03 p.m. Barbara has put me on nuts duty, cashews, pistachios, peanuts for the older kids. As I fill the little glass bowls, I think how grateful I am to be useful.
while a more complicated feeling brings a pain to my chest. Like heartburn, only I haven't eaten yet. Christmas at the Shattucks is hard for me. Here I am in the bosom of a relatively functional family, and every cruel Yule from my childhood reverberates in my bones. I only have to hear Harry Belafonte singing Mary's Boy Child on Radio 2, and I'm there, with Dad lurching into the kitchen, back from the pub, bearing some peace offering for my mother, a frothy lace nightie in the wrong size, a gold watch he's had off a mate on the market. My father always made an entrance like a star, sucking up all the available air in the room. Julie and I were left breathing shallowly behind the settee, praying that she'd forgive him again and that she'd have him back so we could have the kind of Christmas that families were meant to have, the kind Richard's family has. I take some nuts through to the big L-shaped sitting room with the French windows onto the garden. Today is the Shattuck's annual drinks party. A beaming Donald takes my arm and presents me to one of his golf chums. Somewhere in his 60s, the man is wearing a sports jacket and red shirt with a tie only marginally less busy than the test card.
"Jerry, can I introduce my daughter-in-law, Catherine? Catherine's a career lady, you know. Kept her own name. Very modern."
Jerry perks up.
"Do you travel with your work, then, Catherine?"
"Yes, I go to the States a lot, and..."
"So, who looks after Richard when you're away?"
Richard looks after Richard. And the children. And we have a nanny who looks after the children, and, well, it all works somehow."
Jerry nods distractedly, as though I'm bringing him news of some Minoan aqueduct. "Oh, that's marvellous. Do you know Anita Roddick, love?"
"No,
"You've got to hand it to her, haven't you? All that hair. Very striking for her age. And not a spare ounce on her. They often let themselves go at that time of life, don't they?"
"Who?"
"Italians."
"I didn't know Anita Roddick was Italian."
"Oh, why? There's a woman up our road spit of the young Claudia Cardinale before the macaroni cheese had her. What line did Donald say you were in?"
"I'm a fund manager, sort of investing money on behalf of pension funds and companies in..."
"Can't go far wrong with the Bradford and Bingley, I always say. 30-day deposit account, instant access."
"That sounds good."
"I suppose it's your lot wants us in the ruddy euro, is it?"
"No."
"Before you know it, Catherine, Gordon Brown will have us going down the feathers with a pocket of kraut marks. What did we win the war for? Answer me that."
There is a point during these Yuletide conversations when the person you are for the rest of the year, struggling to come up for air through the layers of wrapping paper and saturated fats, finally bursts out like the alien from John Hurt's chest. "Actually, Jerry," I say, more loudly than I intend, "entry to the euro will depend on the level of fiscal imbalances, progress in supply-side reform, and the state of the capital account. Anyway, the global economy is run by Alan Greenspan and the Federal Reserve, so really our focus should be on the US rather than Europe." Jerry rears up and backs into a china cabinet, which tinkles like sleigh bells.
"Well, it's been lovely talking to you, love. Richard's a lucky lad, isn't he? I say, Barbara, your Richard's done well for himself. Your Catherine could go on countdown, she's got that good head on her shoulders, and a lovely little face with it."
Clutching a tumbler of medium sherry, I let myself out through the French windows and fall gratefully into the garden's biting air. Lower myself onto the rockery. "Come on, Kate. Why did you put down that good-hearted old boy in there just now? Showing off. Showing him I wasn't just another blonde in a twin set. He didn't mean any harm. How's poor Jerry supposed to know what manner of woman I am? What strange new species? Back in London, at Edwin Morgan Forster, they think I'm a deviant for having a life outside the office. Up here, people think I'm a freak for having a job instead of a life. Yesterday I told Barbara that Emily loved broccoli. I've no idea if that's true. At EMF, on the other hand, I pretend I read the FT's Lex column every day before work, although if I actually did, I wouldn't sometimes snatch those 13 minutes on the bus with Emily, testing her spellings, chatting, holding hands. Double agents lie for a living. 3:12 p.m.
The entire family, Donald, Barbara, the rest of the grown-ups and assorted grandchildren, is crunching across a field, picking our way between Frisians. A heavy frost has turned the cowpats into doilies. The children jump on them, liberating the evil green liquid beneath. Sky like a Brillo pad, scouring clouds suddenly pierced by implausible am-dram spotlight of sunshine. I'm just admiring the warmth it casts on the facing hills when my mobile rings. Cows and Barbara simultaneously open long-lashed eyes wide, like Elizabeth Taylor told to play shocked.
"What is that dreadful noise, Catherine?"
"Sorry, Barbara, it's my phone."
"Hello? Yes, hello?"
A man's voice bounces off a satellite into the dales. It's Jack Abelhammer, the American client Rod gave me as a consolation prize for not getting a pay rise. The voice is full of waspish scorn. Yanks can't believe our lazy Brit habit of taking the entire week off between Christmas and New Year's. I have yet to meet Mr. Abelhammer, but he sounds like he's capable of living up to his name, and I'm the one about to get nailed.
"For Christ's sake, Catherine Reddy, there's no one in your office. I've been trying for 2 hours. Have you seen what's happened to Tokai Rubber Company?"
"I think I must have missed that, Mr. Abelhammer. Just remind me."
"Play for time, Kate. Play for time."
EMF recently bought a big slug of shares for Abelhammer's fund in Toki Rubber of Japan. Now it turns out that the genius who struck the deal failed to spot that Toki Rubber owns a small U.S. company which manufactures cot mattresses, the same mattresses which have been withdrawn in the States after scientists established a possible link to cot death. Sod, sod, sod. Abelhammer says that when the market opened in Tokyo yesterday, the price collapsed by 15%. Cratered. Can feel my stomach plunge now by equal percentage.
"That stock came highly recommended by you," snaps Abelhammer.
I picture him, a scowling silver tycoon in some New York tower.
"What exactly are you going to do about it? Miss Reddy, can you hear me?"
Spooked from their daydreams, a couple of Frisians have wandered over for an exploratory nuzzle of my borrowed barbour. Whatever happens, I must not let most important client know I am being licked by a cow.
"Well, Mr. Abelhammer, sir, what we must avoid here at all costs is a knee-jerk reaction. Clearly, I need a few days for further analysis, and obviously I'll be talking to our Japanese analyst. As you're probably aware, Roy is the best in the business."
A lie. Analyst is Romford Cokehead, currently on shag and vac in Dubai with pole dancer he picked up in Farringdon Road. Chances of getting appalling little runt out of bed, nil.
"And I will be calling you with a considered plan of action."
Across the field, into Abelhammer's chilly transatlantic silence, floats my mother-in-law's voice, clear as a cathedral bell.
"Really, these Americans, absolutely no sense of tradition."
7:35 p.m. Back at the house, I'm swabbing dung off Emily's mini Bowden trousers. Lilac needle cord. Paula seems to have packed for a week in Florida, not Yorkshire. Should have done the suitcase myself. Cheryl comes into the utility room and pulls a face. Her kids were wearing brown, drip-dry polyester.
"I find it terribly practical."
2:35 a.m. A figure is stooping over our bed. Sit up, reach blindly for light switch. It's my father-in-law.
"Catherine, there's a Mr. Hokusai on the telephone, calling from Tokyo. Seems very anxious to talk to you. Could you kindly take it in the study?"
Donald's voice is frighteningly calm, as if withholding all the things he could possibly say. As I stumble past him in my nightie, he raises a silvery eyebrow. Catch sight of myself in the hall mirror. Realize I'm not wearing nightie. I'm wearing Agent Provocateur bra. Chapter 5. Boxing Day. Well, we made it through the season of goodwill, all right. Except for Boxing Day lunch. I forget the derivation of Boxing Day, but the feeling of wanting to invite your loved ones outside one at a time and punch them in the face, does that come into it somewhere? Anyway, it was all my fault, Richard said, and he wasn't wrong exactly, but I plead gross provocation.
Whenever we're at my in-law's house, I feel as though the children have turned into hand grenades. Any second, the pin may work loose, and they'll explode all over the Eau de Nil chaise longue or take out an entire cabinet of Royal Worcester egg coddlers. Rich and I scurry after them, lunging at falling ornaments, fielders in the dying light of a doomed cricket match. I am longing to drown my sorrows with Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic on the TV, instead of shadowing Ben around the sitting room as he hauls himself up onto spindly occasional tables, chewing on lamp wires or snatching fistfuls of slivered almonds. Weigh up danger of denying baby slivered almonds, thereby risking embarrassing tantrum. Can't she even control her own child? Or allowing him to go ahead and choke, thereby endangering his life and Barbara and Donald's prairie lush Wilton carpet. In the afternoon, while Ben is having his nap, I lie on the bed with my laptop and compose an email to another world. To Deborah Richardson, from Kate Reddy, Rothley, Yorkshire. Dearest Debs, how was it for you? All the elements of the traditional English Christmas here. Sausage rolls, carols, subtle recriminations. Mother-in-law busy preparing emergency food parcel for son neglected by callous city bitch. Me. You know that I always say I want to be with my children. Well, I really want to be with my children. Some nights if I get home too late for Emily's bedtime, I go to the laundry basket and I smell their clothes. I miss them so much. Never told anyone that before. And then when I'm with them, like I am now, their need is just so needy. It's like having a whole love affair crammed into a long weekend. Passion, kisses, bitter tears, I love you, don't leave me, get me a drink, you like him more than me, take me to bed, you've got lovely hair, cuddle me, I hate you. Drained and freaked out and need to go back to work soonest for a rest. What kind of mother is afraid of her own children? Yours, Rothley, Kate, kisses. I am about to hit send, but instead I press delete. There's only so much you can confess, even to your dearest friend, even to yourself. 3:57 a.m. Emily is sick. Excitement, I think. Too much Tweenie's chocolate, plus large and unaccustomed helping of Mummy. Just got off the phone to Japanese Rubber Company and am slipping into bed next to a snoring Richard when there is a cry from the neighbouring room as though an animal were being hunted in a dream. I go in and find Em sitting up in bed, cupping her left ear. There is sick everywhere. Over her nightie, her duvet. Oh God, Barbara's duvet. Her blankie, her sheep, her hippopotamus, even her hair. She looks up at me with beseeching horror. Emily hates any loss of dignity.
"I feel sick, Mummy. Don't let me be sick again," she pleads.
I carry her across the landing to the bathroom and hold her over the toilet, arching her clear of the rim as my mother always did for me. I feel my palm cool on her forehead, feel her stomach stiffen suddenly and then relax as what's left in there comes out. Then, when I have undressed us both, we take a silent bath together, and I comb the cranberries from her hair. After finding clean nightwear, changing the bed linen, and tucking Em in, I scrape the Russian salad gunk as best I can from Barbara's duvet cover and leave it to soak in the bath. Then I lie on the floor next to my child's bed and estimate the losses if Abelhammer is so furious that the Salinger Foundation quits Edwin Morgan Forster. $200 million account. Heads will roll. And my head is not even highlighted. No time. Emily presented me with a drawing of myself yesterday. "Oh, is Mummy wearing a lovely brown hat?" I exclaimed.
"No, silly. The top of your hair is brown and the bottom is yellow."
Surprised to feel big little girl tears start to roll down my